such a time as this. You know, after hearing your presentation last night, Ed, and singing this song, I was impressed that we need a reminder from Daniel 11. And I've said this many times before, but Seventh-day Adventists seem to be content to wait for something before we wake up and finish the work. And we know we don't believe that that's right, but we do it anyway because, well, we're Laodicea. And that's what Laodicea does. It falls asleep. But when we talk about anticipating the nearness of Christ's return, there's one principle I think that it's absolutely vital for us to keep in the front burner, in the front of our thinking. What comes first? The preaching of the loud cry, the proclamation, as it were, of Christ's soon return, or the final rapid events, including the final round of persecution? Do world events wake us up so that we give the loud cry, or do we give the loud cry and precipitate the final rapid events? Now, as I read Daniel 11:44, and as I was taught in Erwin Gaines' Daniel class many years ago at Pacific Union College, I'll read the verse first. It says, "Tidings from the east and the north shall alarm him," referring to the king of the north being what the pronoun refers to there, "shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction." So it's the tidings from the east and the north that cause Satan's alarm and cause him to increase the pace of his fury and precipitate the final events. I mean, the way I see it, as long as we're asleep, he's not going to wake us up. He's playing a numbers game. And frankly, he's burying more people than we're baptizing every day, every year. So Satan's content to keep this game going. He knows he has a short time. He's not eager to end the game. The responsibility falls to God's people in anticipating the coming of Christ to have the courage and the faith to stand up and say to the world, Christ's coming is at hand. The tidings from the east and the north, the way I was taught, brings in the story of when the Jews were in Babylon and the news came about the Persians coming, Cyrus as a type of Christ, coming from the east and the north to overthrow Babylon. And that these tidings from the east and the north that trouble the king of the north, that trouble the enemy, are the tidings of the coming of the one that Cyrus is a type of, the coming of Christ. That when we give the message that Christ is coming, and by the way, the message is not Christ is coming soon. The message is Christ's coming is at hand. Christ is coming soon is what I call wiggle words. That's what I tell my 16-year-old daughter when she says, "Daddy, do I have time to get a driver's license before Christ comes? Am I going to get to date, to graduate high school, to go to college, etc., etc., etc.?" And we have learned over the generations that we have to be careful what we tell our kids. And so we say, you know, Christ is coming soon, but we don't really know how soon is soon. And, you know, we don't want to tell them, no, you're never going to be able to do that, because past generations have done that. And a former pastor of mine who has conscientiously said he cannot preach the nearness of Christ's return because his mother married his father, thinking that this was the only chance she'd get to get married because Christ was going to come so soon. And, of course, now they're grandparents. So, you know, there's a certain impact that our history has had on us. And we need to get back to basics. The core of the message is not soon, not one of these days. It's when we have the faith and courage to say that Christ's coming is at hand. Christ is coming, period. That we precipitate the final rapid movements. Does that make sense? So, I don't know what it's going to take to wake us up. But as we think about what it means to be called for such a time as this, I just felt impressed to kind of include that little sidetrack here, because my topic has to do with same-sex marriage and the law of God. And you know, fighting the battles that we did in California last year in supporting Proposition 8 as we did, I was amazed at how many ways Seventh-day Adventists had to become confused over what I thought was a fairly simple proposition and what had been a very simple matter some years earlier when the Pacific Union Conference Executive Committee voted to support an earlier ballot proposition in supporting the definition of marriage as a man and a woman. And there was overwhelming support from the members of the executive committee, lay people and pastors both, expressing their commitment that, of course, marriage is a man and a woman. And of course the church should publicly be willing to say so and to encourage that and to support that. But we anticipated some of this confusion in our discussions at Soquel Camp Meeting last summer. And I'll touch on a little bit of that this morning, because after all, we Seventh-day Adventists believe that one day the state is going to cross the boundary line and legislate religion, legislate religious belief in upholding and enforcing one of the twin institutions that God created, established in the Garden of Eden, which is to say the Sabbath, albeit, you know, when the state gets involved in many things, the state gets it wrong. So when the state gets involved in religion, the state's going to make some mistakes, maybe well-meaning, but the state's going to make some mistakes. And, well, they're trying to uphold and enforce the Sabbath, but they've got the wrong day. And we will stand up and say, keep your hands off the law of God. You're violating the law of God. You have no business legislating the law of God. So if the state has no business legislating the law of God, then why would we turn around on the other hand and say, yes, please do retain and legislate the other institution that God ordained in Eden? Please do retain the definition of marriage and protect marriage as between a man and a woman. Are we being hypocritical and asking the state somehow to protect one of the religious institutions that God established in Eden, but telling the state not to regulate and protect the other institution, the Sabbath, that God established in Eden? So we anticipated some of this possible confusion. And I touched on one of the simple ways to resolve the problem. But even before we get there, obviously, the best way for the state to protect the Sabbath is to leave it alone. When it comes to marriage, even the liberals who want the state to legislate marriage, same-sex marriage, they concede that for the state to legislate marriage does not violate the separation of church and state. It only supposedly violates the separation of church and state if the state were to legislate our view of marriage, not their view of marriage. But their view of marriage has just as much of a moral and religious basis as our view does. We disagree about the morality. We disagree about the religious interpretation. But there are plenty of churches that advance moral and religious grounds for approving of same-sex marriage. And of course, ours is among those churches that hold to more traditional biblical views that do not approve of same-sex marriage. So whose religion should the state endorse? Well, the short answer is the state should not be in the business of endorsing religion at all, right? So this brings us back to the bright line distinction we talked about yesterday. The first table of the law and the second table of the law. Aha! I wasn't paying attention, but markers mysterious. Did somebody actually bring these up? You know, my house could be burning down, and I wouldn't even know it. You remember that old Please Don't Eat the Daisies where, you know, she had writer's block and she couldn't write because everybody was being quiet and trying to, you know, let her write, and it was only when all the dogs and the kids were going nuts that she could come. All right. I'm dating myself, I'm afraid. All right. So let's do this. Art skills. Now, what we're trying to do here is have two tables. The first one with four commandments and the next one with the latter six. And the bright line distinction is that the first table of the law, the first four commandments, the state has no legitimate authority to touch. The state has no business telling us who God is, outlawing idolatry, blasphemy, enforcing Sabbath keeping, telling us, you know, who to worship, when to worship, where, how, why, whatever. Matters of religious belief are properly the jurisdiction of the community. The keys of the kingdom have been given to the church, not to the state. The second table of the law, on the other hand, reflects our social obligations, man's relationship to fellow man, marriage, adultery, theft, perjury, covetousness, murder. I'm trying to remember what I left out. See, I wasn't brought up in the church. I didn't, you know, learn all these by memory verse as a kid. All of these are things that are the valid subject of legislation. Does it mean that the state must legislate in a certain way? No. But it does mean that it's legitimate for the state to address human relationships and to regulate them. We all understand that the state has an interest in what happens to property rights and custody rights and children incident to divorce. The state has to provide a legal structure for marriage. And for there are those who say, well, no, they should not, but it's just not possible. The state will have to do it. The argument is over how the state should do it. And both sides of the debate, frankly, agree that the state should regulate marriage. The disagreement is over what marriage ought to be. So I think that bright line distinction helps us to resolve the confusion over why, as Seventh-day Adventists, we can advocate in favor of traditional marriage without being hypocritical when at the same time we will ask the state not to touch the Sabbath. What we faced last year were a few Adventists who are what I would call believing Adventists, and a number of others who really do not believe in our eschatology, who insisted that if we invite the state to regulate religion with respect to marriage, we're just bringing the state that much closer to Sunday laws because we're inviting the state to get into the business of religion. Once they do one, you know they're going to do the next one. Well, I found that to be an insidious way of acting in rebellion against the law of God and actually undermining the law of God. And so the topic today really is not so much about the implications of same-sex marriage, which, time permitting, we'll get to. But in all these struggles about marriage and the role of the church, it has drawn me to a deeper understanding of the law of God and of our calling, of our prophetic calling as Adventists. Our theme this week is called for such a time as this. Let's turn in our Bibles and go back to Isaiah chapter 58. I was taught when I came into the church that this passage had special relevance for Seventh-day Adventists, for our mission, for our calling. And reading in verse 12, this is a modern translation, so it may sound a little different to you. "And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in." Ellen White quotes this passage in connection in Prophets and Kings with the story of Ezra and Nehemiah and the leadership that they provided as the Jews came home to Israel, to Jerusalem, after years of captivity in Babylon. And they found their nation, they found their city in ruin. And they began the work of restoration, of rebuilding the city, of rebuilding the community, and rebuilding the spiritual foundations of the nation. The story that's told in the book of Nehemiah. And she likens it to the spiritual restoration that will take place before the second coming of Christ. And how we are to call Christians, call people to come out of Babylon and to return to the city of God, to the kingdom of God, to the family of God, and to rebuild the spiritual foundations that have been broken down and repair the damage of many, many, many generations. And in so doing, specifically to repair the breach in the law of God. Amen? So let me ask you today, what are the big issues that need to be repaired with respect to the law of God? Historically, Seventh-day Adventists got very excited when we rediscovered the Sabbath. And we invested a tremendous amount of energy in trying to convince other Christians that they needed to change the day of worship and to recover the Sabbath. And I fear that our passion and zeal for the Sabbath has blinded us to the fact that there are other important issues regarding the law of God, that it's not enough to repair one breach in the law. In fact, Ellen White says every institution must be restored. Let me see if I can find the exact quote here. "In the time of the end, every divine institution is to be restored." And then she talks about restoring the Sabbath. Does that include marriage? What about some of these other commandments? Are we in gross violation in our culture of other commandments as well? Do we need to repair the breach? You know, when we look at Isaiah, the context of repairing the breach, what is the whole first half, two-thirds of the chapter devoted to? It's devoted to oppression and injustice in the name of, by people for whom formal religion has become predominant, right? They have a form of godliness, but they fast for strife and wickedness and go through the motions of their religious observances while being dishonest in business and oppressing their workers and on, right? So tomorrow, I think, flows very nicely from today when we look at the biblical texts that deal with the economy. I'm not going to step on Ed's toes and try to do a stewardship lecture. And I'm really I was really nervous about even taking on this topic, knowing that Ed was going to be here. I kind of feel like I'm a kid, you know, in school performing for a teacher or something. But, you know, we've got the stewardship guy here, and I'm going to talk about the economy. Well, what I'm going to talk about is the violation of the Tenth Commandment and the implications of what happens when we trash the Tenth Commandment. We say, oh, well, you can't legislate, you can't legislate greed and covetousness. Well, we just found out what happens when you don't regulate greed in the marketplace. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow. I think the law of God is very relevant. And I think that it is present truth for us to proclaim the relevance of God's law to many aspects of society today. But I think first I want to take a little closer look at the law of God. Because one of the issues that was raised in this Prop 8 debate is, well, when you Christians are arguing for traditional marriage, aren't you just asking the state to approve a religious view? And, you know, we don't all share your religious view, so why legislate religion? So that raises questions about the nature of God's law. So let me ask you this. Is God's law just a bunch of rules for religious people who want to be good and want to go to heaven, and so we're going to do what God says because we want to please God, and, you know, we want to play by the rules, and they're for us, religious people who want to be part of God's family. But, you know, if you don't want to be religious, if you don't want to be, saved, you don't want to go to heaven, then the rules are really irrelevant to you because they're really just for religious people. Is that what God's law is? And, if we obey them, then we'll go to heaven. If we break them, then we're, you know. Well, the theologians like to talk about the literary structure and chiasms. And I drew this in the form of a chiasm, which is kind of a mountain. And so what you see in the structure of the Ten Commandments is you see 4 and 5 here at the heart of the law. Now, there's something else in the structure that points in the same direction. 4 and 5 are the only commandments that are stated in the positive. Remember and honor, right? The rest of them are stated in the negative. Thou shalt not. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't commit perjury. Don't covet. No idolatry. No blasphemy. Right? Don'ts. 2 that are stated in the positive. So if you think about it, the 2 institutions that God established in Eden are also the foundation for religious society and civil society. Now, if you think about it, if you really faithfully observe and remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, the first 3 commandments really aren't going to be much trouble at all. They're really all summed up and brought to the full here in the 4th commandment. You're not going to struggle with taking the Lord's name in vain, with idolatry, with blasphemy, and etc., if you have this weekly with God and preserve and honor. The Sabbath is really the culmination of our spiritual life, our spiritual obligations to love and to serve. It's the foundation of the church, of the religious society. Well, honor your father and mother, the first commandment with promise. What does it mean to honor your father and your mother? I think sometimes we have a rather casual or shallow understanding of that. I think it's rather deep myself. And I can't help as a parent with 4 teenagers first to say that it applies, I see how it applies to me as a father. Maybe even before I try to beat my kids over the head, apply it to them. But you know, I feel like as a father, I'm required to be worthy of the respect and the trust and the love and affection of my children. That this commandment holds me to a high standard of integrity and faithfulness, my relationship, my wife, and to my children. And I think, you know, honor is a term that can broadly encompass a wide range of positive attitudes, of children not only showing respect or obedience for parents, but kindness, thoughtfulness, and on. And now I ask you, if that is the experience in the home, are the rest of these thou shalt not going to be a real big temptation? If you have that kind of foundation in the family, won't it be relatively that much easier for your children to practice faithfulness in their own marital relations, integrity in their business dealings, and honesty, not to covet, etc., to be content with the blessings that God has given them? Can you see that obedience to the fifth commandment is really the foundation for society, for a healthy and happy home? And the home and the family is the foundation for a healthy, stable, and prosperous society. Okay? Now, this all suggests to me a very different understanding of the law of God than maybe what we sometimes think. I think it's common for us to think, to at least to feel as though the law of God is somehow restrictive. That the law of God, you know, is something that would deprive us of our freedom or of opportunities to experience things in life that we might prefer. And, you know, God is clipping our wings so that we'll be good. Well, I rather suggest that God is our creator and that He designed us and that when He gave us His law, He was describing the way life really works. Now, there was a time a couple of years ago before I drove one that I thought it would be really nice to have a bright, shiny. I thought that was a pretty hot looking car. And and I thought it would be really cool to have one. Then we rented one and decided to do a road trip and drove from Sacramento to, you know, it was fun for a while. But, you know, if I had gotten one of those nice 350Zs, it would come with a manual. And, you know, if I decided to ignore the manual and just drive it and drive it and drive it and, you know, maybe just stick some gas in it, never change the oil, it wouldn't be too long before I'd be left crying on the side of it to operate very well if I didn't take proper care of it. Manual wasn't there to restrict my love of driving or my joy of the open road. It was there to help me get the most out. And I rather think of the law of God in that light, that it's not there to restrict us. It's there to show us the very best that life has to offer. And so I would make this observation, especially with respect to the second table of the law. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to desire a relationship with God or have any desire to go to heaven or any desire for religion whatsoever. But if you internalize and practice the second table of blessing in your life, be happier and healthier and better adjusted. Your family life will be better. You will have a much better life because you practice the principles of honor and respect in the family, integrity in your marriage relations and your business relations, of honesty, etc., etc. Good way to live. It's how the Creator designed us to live. Is that right? Now, if that's true, then we don't need to go into the public debate over marriage and argue about religion. We don't need to say that marriage ought to be preserved as a man and a woman because God said so in the book of Genesis. Religious arguments are fine for religious people, but they're meaningless for those who are not religious. Instead, if we really understand what the law of God is, then we would expect to find objective, secular evidence that preserving marriage is a man in a society. We don't need to bring religion into it at all, because if God is wiser than men, what about the wisdom? We can take the wisdom of God as our foundation, and we can find ways to communicate that wisdom without reference to religion. Now, there's a marvelous book, I think I brought it with me, called The Future of Marriage by David Blankenhorn. And if you have an interest in this topic, that's probably the best single book. A lifelong researcher and professional student of both the history of marriage and the nature of marriage, what Blankenhorn points out is that marriage has historically, across cultures, across religions, across civilizations, marriage has been universally defined as a child-centered institution. That marriage is a child-centered institution for the preservation of society, It's for raising the next generation. And that's the emphasis, the social emphasis of marriage. Now, does that mean that there's anything wrong with people who are not able to bear children somehow getting married, or getting married, after their childbearing years, or other things? No, of course not. But that's the overarching purpose of marriage from a social standpoint, the purpose of marriage in terms of the society. What Blankenhorn observes is that the intellectual shift that is reflected in the drive for same-sex marriage is a shift from marriage as a child-centered institution to marriage as a reflection of personal autonomy and personal sexual fulfillment. And the new ethic is that the state should not interfere with the individual's autonomy and right to sexual expression and sexual fulfillment. Now, when Rick Santorum served in the Senate in Pennsylvania, from representing Pennsylvania, he pointed out the obvious, and he was severely criticized publicly when he said that, well, if you redraw these boundaries, where do you stop? Where do you stop? If the new premise is personal autonomy and personal sexual fulfillment, and guess what? It's our generation that bequeathed this to the world. Thank you very much. We'll take credit for it. The sexual revolution of the 60s. If that's the new premise, then how do you continue to restrict all sorts of multiple forms of partnership and marriage relationship? How do you say to someone who claims to be bisexual and they say, well, I'm entitled to my fulfillment too, and I want to marry a man and a woman? And, I ran this by my sister-in-law when we were on summer vacation last year. And the authorities had recently raided the compound, the polygamous compound in Texas. I'd actually done a Fox Cable News interview about that raid. The brethren were very, very worried about what I would say. It went just fine, though, but they were... Anyway, so I asked Robin what she thought about a variety of forms of marriage or in society, except she really, is a very modern, secular New York Jew. she didn't see anything wrong with any of it. And I think, you know, sometimes we lose touch with the way people are thinking. And so, you know, we think, well, is this real? We might revisit the legitimacy of polygamy. Polygamy, if it gets revisited, will be revisited because there is a religious basis for it. The case that I'm still expecting one of these days is when the third or fourth wife of some Arab sheikh who put up in a mansion in Beverly Hills decides that she likes it here in America more than being under the thumb of, you know, a male chauvinist Muslim culture. And she has her kids here and goes into court in Southern California and sues for divorce and custody. And the court has to address, well, but you're the third or you're the fourth wife. What are we going to do with this case? And, of course, they're going to feel an obligation to make some sort of legal provision, economic provision for the children and such. And, you know, I don't know what's going to come of that kind of thing. But I can imagine the courts are going to have to confront these issues in ways that may be rather sympathetic for the courts to grant some sort of legal status and direction. Now, having said that, my clients always ask me, you know, what's going to be the outcome? Are we going to win the case, or how much money will we get? And I have to remind them that when I graduated law school, they gave me a license. They didn't give me a crystal ball. And I rather think when people ask you about when Christ is coming, you know, you might adapt that own line for yourselves and insist that you don't have a crystal ball either. It's one thing to recognize the signs of the times and to be ready. It's another thing, you know, we should avoid intemperate predictions. But Adventists haven't always been very good at that, have we? back to Isaiah 58. We have been called to champion the law of God. And yet, we've had some difficulty doing that. I was baptized by Morris Vendon at Pacific Union College in 1979, Thanksgiving weekend, a month after Desmond Ford, a famous speech in Irwin Hall, where he was attempting, I think, to resolve a very basic dilemma that had been confronted with in terms of Adventist experience, and to resolve it through theological means. I don't think he did it successfully, but I'm sympathetic to the problem that he was addressing. Because I think the problem that Ford was addressing was that Adventism had established a standard for salvation of a very high level of performance, that it was necessary to achieve a degree of obedience and perfection that was seemingly beyond the possibility of, and that our experience was that we had this idea of perfection and of obedience, but we had the experience of our own imperfection and our own sin and our own failing. And there was a cognitive dissonance there. And there was this tremendous burden of guilt that came from trying to obey sincerely and constantly falling short. And something had to give. And yes, something did have to give. Now, what Ford did was essentially to bring the standard down to or below the level of our own experience in order to resolve the problem of that burden of guilt. Now, I rather think, and I've observed and I've talked with others who have observed the same thing, that within Adventism, both among liberals and conservatives, there is a tendency to a self-centered, narcissistic, performance-based religion. What do I mean by that? It really doesn't matter whether you set the standard of performance very high, as conservatives do, Or you lower the standard of performance to a very low level, as some liberals do, and you say, well, as you know, liberals are prone to saying, well, you know, Jesus loves me and accepts me just the way I am, and it's not based on my performance and accepted if by my faith in Christ. Conservatives say, yes, but faith without works is dead, and you know, Christ requires our obedience and to set the standard of high as conservatives. But either way, the tendency is look to one's own performance. And conservatives may take some solace in saying, well, you know, we're obedient, and therefore we're okay. You know, we pay our tithe, and we go to church on Sabbath, and, you know, we tithe mint and anise and cumin, and learned about the weightier matters of the law also. Liberals may also look to performance and say, well, you know, everybody... No, but I have faith in Christ, and I'm loved. So on both sides, there can be legalism. There can still be a performance-based religion. What does the Bible say about human righteousness? We're clear on that, right? It's not about where we set the standard of performance, low or high. This is a false conflict between liberals and conservatives as to whether we should set the standard low or high. Because the real issue is the only righteousness any one of us will ever be able to claim is the righteousness found in Jesus Christ himself. Is that right? Which is our birthright. And by the way, we are not saved by our faith. It's his faith. And it's a gift also. The commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. It belongs to him first, and it's a gift to us. That faith took him through Gethsemane. That faith took him through Calvary. That faith, as a gift, even as a grain of mustard seed, will take us through whatever this world has to throw at us. It won't be Gethsemane, and it won't be Calvary. It may not be pleasant, but that faith will take. If you trust in your own faith, if you trust in your own performance, you will be disappointed. And you will have guilt. And you will be insecure. You trust in his righteousness and the faith that he has given to you. If you question, Lord, do I have faith? Answer, doesn't matter. It's not about how much faith you have. I have the faith that you've given me, Lord. And I know that's enough. It took you through Calvary, it'll take me through. Much more secure basis when our trust is in his righteousness and his faith instead of our own. Is that right? Now, the reason that I harp on this in context with our discussion of the law of God is because what I have witnessed in this church in the last 30 years is how far and how fast we have backpedaled away from being champions of the law of God. And the reason, to me, makes all the sense in the world psychologically. It's because of the legacy of legalism. As long as our attitude and approach and experience of the law of God is this huge burden of guilt, and this huge weight of you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do the other thing, and religion makes me miserable, we're not going to joyously champion the law of God. We're not going to repair the breach in anything. The first thing we have to do if we want to champion the law of God and repair the breach in the law is we've got to place our feet on a firm gospel foundation. Amen. We've got to recover the righteousness of Christ, recover the gospel for ourselves. That's number one. Is that fair? Only when we see the law as liberating, as fulfilling, as a promise of the kind of life that God will give us through faith. Isn't that what the law really is? A promise of the kind of life that we can lead by faith. If you have people that you work with who have struggles with, say, honesty, integrity. And, you know, you can say to them, you shouldn't lie. They already know that. How about saying to them, God can help you to live a life of integrity? You know, sometimes when we stare at our tax returns, it takes faith to put down the true numbers. I'm not stepping on any toes here. That's not why you're laughing, is it? But you see my point? The law is a promise. But for so many of us, it's been a burden. It's been a noose around our necks. It's been choking our spiritual life. Joyce, a promise in the life that God has given to us, in the hope of a life of worship, of a healthy and happy family, and of a life lived that enjoy the righteous and not the restlessness of those who bear a load of cannot rest and sleep, as the proverb says. So we need to repair the breach in the law. But to repair the breach in the law means more than simply telling people. And, you know, my question for church leaders last year as we were debating the public position that we should take with respect to marriage was, is our calling to repair the breach in the law simply dealing with one of the two that God established? Or, as Ellen White said, are we to restore every divine? Now, what happens? What is the risk? Let's think strategically for a moment. We come down to the final conflict, and the issue of Sabbath and Sunday is being debated. And we Adventists, you know, we publicly insist that Saturday is a Sabbath, sundown Friday, sundown Saturday, and that we ought to have the legal right to observe the Sabbath according to the dictates of our own conscience, and that the law of God is under attack and we're standing in defense of the law of God. I fear that our Christian brothers and sisters are going to come to us and laugh in our faces. You Adventists don't really care about the law of God. This is just about self-interest. You've got the wrong day. It's really not about the law of God. If you really cared about the law of God, where have you been for the last generation or two? When we have been battling over the law of God, when we've been battling over the commandment against murder and the murder of the unborn, when we've been battling over the issues of marriage and adultery and homosexuality and upholding the law of God when it comes to sexual fidelity, where have you been? If you Adventists really care about the law of God, why have you been so? I think there is grave risk for us. Now, having said that, am I suggesting that we simply join the religious right and make common cause with them? No. We are not the religious right, and we never will be, for many, many reasons. We are, as I described it yesterday, the lonely middle. We're somewhere in between. We need not to follow the agenda of the left or the right. We need to understand what it means to be called for such a time. We need to understand our own calling and be faithful to our own mission and not worry about, you know, what the right is doing, what the left is doing, but let's understand our own calling. And part of that calling is to champion the law of God. Now, we have a few more minutes remaining, and so I would like to tell you something of the risks that homosexuality, gay rights, and same-sex marriage pose for the church, because I think these risks are very serious. And we're going to have a conference at Andrews University in the fall addressing marriage, homosexuality, and the church from an interdisciplinary level. But I'll be discussing some of these things at that time. Your neighbor to the south, California, When the California Supreme Court ruled that homosexual couples have a constitutional right to marry, a right that was essentially a decision that was overturned by the voters when they passed Proposition 8. What the voters did not overturn, however, was the legal basis, the legal analysis that led to the court's decision. The legal analysis essentially equates, for the first time, homosexuality and race. So the implications that we need to understand for the church are the implications of equating homosexuality with race. So I know there's some of you from Idaho. Idaho has a reputation for being home to some white supremacists. Now, even in a state like Idaho, I suppose that if the white supremacists wanted to start a school and only admit white students and only hire white teachers, that they would be fairly quickly sued for discrimination, and a court order would be entered prohibiting them from practicing that kind of discrimination. And if they continued to do so, eventually the fines, the contempt of court fines, would be levied and they would be shut down. It's simply not possible any longer, no matter what your religious belief is, it's not possible to operate a racially discriminatory institution, a school, a hospital, what have you, in this country. That was very clear back in 1982, I think it was, when the Supreme Court handed down a decision upholding the decision of the Internal Revenue Service to take away tax exemption from Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University lost its tax exemption because they had retained, they had been an old-fashioned Southern white segregationist college, but they had complied with the laws as they changed, except that they continued to prohibit interracial dating of students. And the IRS felt that they were, that policy was so out of harmony with our principles of non-discrimination that they pulled their tax-exempt status. Now, I'm not here to, argue the merits or the problems of the Bob Jones case. I just want you to understand that in the future, should the law develop and continue and the principles that the California Supreme Court enunciated be further developed, then we can expect the same kind of logic applied to the church for retaining our historic teachings and beliefs about human sexuality and marriage, that eventually they would be regarded as discriminatory and we would lose our tax-exempt status, we would lose the freedom to operate institutions where we practice our own beliefs. Now, how realistic is this threat? Well, just to the north of where you live, Ed, in New Jersey, they don't have same-sex marriage, but they do have domestic partnerships. And there's a beautiful camp meeting facility owned by the Methodist Church on the Jersey Shore, and a gay couple asked to be able to have a commitment ceremony there. And the Camp Meeting Association said, no, we can't approve of this kind of ceremony on our Methodist property. Well, that case is still in litigation. But in the early stages of the case, the Camp Meeting Association was fined, and a portion of the property was subjected to real property tax assessments that had previously been exempt. Now, we don't know what the outcome of the case will be, but I think it shows the risks. There are at least some legal scholars who have publicly said that in the conflict between gay rights and religious freedom, they cannot imagine any instance where the church should prevail over. Clearly, there are going to be many areas of conflict, and we can't predict whether, you know, the pendulum will swing or not, or whether there will be a backlash. All I can do is faithfully report what the current issues are, what the status of the law is, and what the risks are that we face. They're very real. Some within the church have observed and compared same-sex marriage to divorce. A generation ago, there was a huge stigma attached within the church to divorce. And it was a time when pastors who divorced, even if it wasn't their fault, were no longer in ministry. Now, I'm not here to comment on the wisdom of those policies, simply to observe that church attitudes and practices have shifted dramatically along with the culture in the past generation. And now, discipline for divorce is much more rare, isn't it? Doesn't change the moral issues. What I'm suggesting is, today, it would be a, you know, pretty much of a big stink if there were a gay wedding performed in an Adventist church. If the pendulum could shift, and if time were to last, in a generation or so, we might expect that same-sex marriages in our churches would have the same stigma as divorces do today, that they would be more or less commonplace, because the church tends to change with the culture. So there are, we cannot simply bury our heads in the sand and say, well, we know what we believe, and we're going to believe and to practice our faith regardless of what happens in the culture. The sociologists call that pietism. Pietism can be derided as those who are so heavenly minded that they are of little earthly good. Pietism describes the church that essentially divorces itself from the concerns of society and simply goes about the business of the church. The religious right, of course, has at times tended to the other ditch of a religion of politics and of seeking to establish the kingdom of God through political means, to establish it as an earthly dominion. Well, clearly, that's going too far the other way. Somewhere in between, as Bill Knott will be putting more and more in the Adventist Review and has already begun to publish and to preach about, we as Adventists have a long history of engagement in social issues, beginning with slavery and our involvement even before we were a formal denomination in the, what do you call the movement to, well, prohibition later, but the Underground Railroad, exactly, and helping those slaves who had escaped. And then, of course, our missionary work in the South was quite radical. And the idea that we would have missionaries go and try to raise up churches among the freed slaves, that was even controversial within our own ranks. But whether it was our advocacy against slavery, our advocacy on temperance issues and prohibition, we have a long history as a church of being engaged. And today, I suggest that we need to take our calling as champions of the law of God seriously. We do that if we do it with a sound recognition of what the separation of church and state means. On the one hand, we want to urge the state to keep its hands off of religion. But on the other hand, we can communicate the wisdom of God when it comes to issues like marriage. We can communicate that in secular terms, in objective terms. Children need a father There's a movement afoot in the media to describe the children of gay couples as well-adjusted, as within the norms of their sexual orientation, that they're no more likely to become homosexual than children who are raised with a father and a mother. There's all kinds of research that's out there that documents why the nuclear family is best. For debates are going to come, the battles are going to come. I don't care what state you live in, it's going to come to your hometown, and it's going to come to your. The question is, are we going to be salt and light? Are we going to reclaim our calling as repairers of the breach, repair the foundations, to look at the problems in our society and say, you know, for us and our churches. Well, I'm Greg, I'm going to quit early. I've said my piece. I'm going to have prayer. Give our tushies a break. Okay. We can do that. Comments or questions? Yes, sir. Did the Trial Lawyers Association... I honestly don't know. Did the Trial Lawyers Association support... in other words, oppose Proposition 8?
I just wanted to ask, what's the current situation in California?
Sure. Well, the California Supreme Court heard the challenge earlier this year to Proposition 8, the suggestion that it was somehow unconstitutional for the people to amend the Constitution, and the court rightly respected the right of the people to be the final arbiters of what the Constitution says. And they upheld Proposition 8. There are now some very prominent attorneys who filed a challenge in federal court in San Francisco seeking to have Proposition 8 declared unconstitutional. I rather doubt that they will succeed ultimately, although I think their strategy is probably that they have a fighting chance in either the district court or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals because of the liberal bent. The problem with any lower court lower federal court overturning Prop 8 as a matter of federal law is that the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear that homosexuality is not a protected class for equal protection purposes, and that there are no specific when you're not a protected class, then you apply the rational basis test, and basically the law will be upheld as against any kind of equal protection challenge. So I don't know whether a particular judge will give them the time of day, but the legal arguments that they're likely to raise really do not have any traction at the federal level. But of Supreme Court, I might add, if they get up to the Supreme Court, I really don't think they have a ghost of a chance of overturning Prop 8.
I guess I would have to say that I am offended by your analogy of divorced being the same stigma as gay rights. There are lots of reasons why there are divorces, and I don't put the same stigma on both of those. Why did you?
Okay, maybe you misunderstood me, because I'm not trying to put them in the same moral category or suggest that the stigma is the same. What I am suggesting is that just as we've seen an attitudinal shift in the church towards divorce, that we're likely, and the shift that has tracked with the culture, we're likely to see the same shift. We could have a whole long discussion about the subject of divorce. I've been divorced, so I'm, a victim of divorce, if you want to put it that way. I did not mean to certainly take pot shots at anyone who has suffered through that, or to somehow say that, being divorced is somehow a moral equivalent or to be compared with the issue of same-sex marriage. So I appreciate being able to clarify that.
How would you personally answer somebody on the question from a non-religious standpoint. You talked about that, but how would you personally answer somebody that wanted to defend homosexual marriage? And you were not.
Well, look, for starters, I think we need to shift the burden of proof. And maybe this is kind of a lawyerly way to go about it, but in the history of civilization, across religions, across cultures, marriage has always been a man and a woman. Those who want to change it and change the definition of marriage bear the burden of proving why this is going to be good for society. I don't think that there is any evidence that would support making this dramatic shift as being risk-free. The evidence that we do have from countries that have implemented they would use the term progressive laws regarding marriage, marriage light, and making it easier to get into and out of marriages, etc. What we have found is that the duration of relationships is shortened, and that more and more children are being raised in single-parent households. So the data that we have suggests that when we take legal measures to weaken traditional marriage, that it has a negative impact both on the durability of relationships and on the economic stance, because we know that children raised by single parents suffer tremendous economic disadvantages over being raised in two-parent homes. There are all kinds of objective data as to why children suffer when we change and weaken the bonds of traditional marriage. Ed, you had a... Ed Reed was reminding us that the current issue of Time magazine has a large spread about why marriage is important and why it's better for kids.
Well, I had a comment about sin. It seems that the progression of sin makes it less sinful. And with the homosexual agenda, as with any sin, the more familiar we become with it, the less sinful it appears. And now I had a question for you about the law that I've always wondered as a Seventh-day Adventist. I was not raised an Adventist, but I truly believe in the message. But my question is about abortion. If we stand for the law concerning same-sex marriage, and it is part of society, why does our church not take a stand against the murder of innocent children?
Going to have to wait your turn, I think. You know, I'm not an expert on the history of how our church has come to it has in terms of abortion. What I'm perceiving is that now, going back actually to a conference that was reported to me, it was held in Loma Linda back in the early 80s. In terms of the range of opinion within the Adventist Church, I think is fairly narrow. That for the most part, there's consensus that abortion is immoral, except within a narrow range of circumstances. There is not consensus on what the legal status should be. And so I think the church has been very reluctant to go beyond any kind of moral, issue of moral guidance and start to try to say, well, the law should be this or that. I will tell you, in my discussions with pro-lifers, I don't sense that there is any clarity or consistency in the pro-life movement as to what the law should be and whether we should punish and lock up women, whether we should lock up doctors, etc. I think, you know, abortion is a much more difficult issue. When it comes to saying it's relatively easy to say, well, you know, we think that the the slaughter of the unborn is murder, and it's a grave evil. It's much more difficult than to say, well, so what are we going to do? Are we going to put the doctors in prison, execute them? Are we going to execute mothers, teenage women who choose abortion? Are we going to send them back to the back alleys and the coat hangers and the botched abortions when thousands of women die? You know, it's a very difficult issue. And of course, there are those within our midst who are staunchly pro-choice and who don't see, who don't believe that abortion is murder. You have both sides within the church.
Okay. You made a statement, the church tends to change. A little bit later you said, Seventh-day Adventists have had a long engagement in social issues. And
yeah.
Your implication was, we were against slavery, we wanted to minister in the South, we went against temperance issues, where we were real strong. What do you see as the real change that's taking place? The church, or is it...
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, but certainly the culture has greatly shifted, and I think that the church has changed with it. I mean, I think if you... I don't honestly know...
What do you mean the church is changing with it? You mean we're becoming like the culture?
Well, of course. Our values and our practices tend to mirror that of the culture. Our divorce rate is consistent with the general divorce rate in America, and at least what statistics are available generally is issues of whether it's domestic violence or child abuse within conservative Christianity as a whole mirror or exceed that of the nation as a whole. And I suspect if we did surveys of attitudes and practices among Adventist young people, you would find that either sexual activity or, the percentage of those who feel sexual intimacy should be reserved for marriage is very, very low. Okay.
Well,
I certainly don't sense that attitude being very prevalent in the academies where my kids have gone to school.
Now, was that true in our first couple of generations?
Well, I'm not an Adventist historian. So there may be others here who can answer that better than I. Go easy on me, Laura.
I just wanted to make a comment on the abortion issue. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and I think a lot of people don't understand the whole history of abortion over the last 3,000 years. And there's a wonderful book that you can buy called Pro-Life, The Development of a Roman Catholic Perspective. And it gives the history of abortion over the last 3,000 years. And I'd really encourage any of you to buy that book and read it. My husband bought it for me. And what I wanted to say here and emphasize in everyone's mind is that here in America, we can separate the issue of birth control and abortion, because if a woman wants birth control here, they can go get it. And so... there's really no reason that a woman here would need an abortion, because she can just get the birth control. But that is not the case in most of the rest of the world, where the Catholic Church is very influential to barring any birth control. And so therefore, in these countries where the church is very powerful and blocks the birth control, then the women are left with a choice. They have a choice to continue to have child after child after child and perhaps die in childbirth or start having those abortions. And I read this one study in Russia that the average Russian woman has 7 abortions before she cannot get pregnant again, because the Russian Orthodox Church bans birth control. And so I would really encourage you to think in terms of birth control and abortion, because if you read the history of birth control and abortion, the Catholic Church views them as the same. Birth control, using any type of birth control, is called an intentional abortion,
mm-hmm.
and that is doing anything to prevent a birth is an intentional abortion, and then an actual abortion is called a real abortion. And so the at the height of the enforcement of the Catholic Church in the year about 1100, the Catholic Church would fine the couples who had these abortions or did birth control. And the birth control that was used was drinking lead or mercury.
Ouch.
Yeah. And so because if a woman drank lead or mercury very many times, she wouldn't be able to get pregnant anyway. They were seen as like a mix of the two. And that's why the Catholic Church to this day sees them as a mix of the two. And so when any of you think in terms of outlawing abortion and, you know, send those doctors to prison and send the women to prison, realize that what you're really thinking in terms of is more of a Catholic theology.
I got the cut sign from your husband, but I couldn't bring myself to using that as an excuse to cut off his wife. So I didn't think I'd be in good shape if I did that. But I almost forgot, Laura, at least you gave me a pause to remember, that I brought a few copies of a book that my wife and I edited and I'm a principal contributor to, that was published last year, called Politics and Prophecy, The Battle for Religious Liberty and the Authentic Gospel. And it has contributions from many of our church's religious liberty leaders. We tried to make it quite readable in editing it. And I just brought a few because I was driving, so I put my 1,000 miles to work. And I'm going to do a book signing there at the back. We have them for $12 a piece. If you want, I mean, they're certainly available from the ABC and all if we run out. So I don't imagine that my signature is such a prized possession. But anyway, let's go ahead and close with prayer. Father in heaven, truly you have called us for such a time as this. And we know that in these last days, there is grave risk of deception and confusion, even among the very elect. And so we pray for wisdom, for humility of mind, for ears to hear, to be ever learning and growing in grace and knowledge and wisdom and faith, Lord. And may we faithfully recover the mission to be champions of the law of God and to repair the breach, to be salt and light and a positive influence in our towns. May it begin with the strong families that we build.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.